I know it hurt, Falcon, but it had to be done for the animal.
Falcon turned to the badge-wearing man.
Yeah, Billy.
Are you all right?
Yeah, I'm fine, thanks.
It's a shame when animals get caught up in the doings of man. They wind up suffering through no fault of their own.
Yeah. The others did. The one by the hardware and the one by the feed store.
They are, and so is the one hanging from the livery. You got any idea who these fellows are or why they tried to ambush you?
I'm thinking it's probably Luke Mueller.
Yeah, that fits.
Fits what?
You're a wanted man, Falcon.
Like hell. There's no paper out on me.
There is now. I took this off the fellow lying over there in front of the feed store.
Sheriff Billy Farrell handed a circular to Falcon.
You're wanted, all right, but not by the law.
The circular was exactly like the reward dodgers the law put out for wanted men, in every way, shape, and form. Only this one had not been put out by the law. It read, "Reward to anyone who kills Falcon McAllister. $1,000 will be paid when proof of death is furnished to Luke Mueller."
You know this here Mueller fella?
Sort of. I killed his brother a few weeks ago.
Oh, yeah. I read about it in the paper.
I reckon Luke Mueller's trying to get even with me.
You think one of these men was Luke Mueller?
Yeah, but he isn't one of the ones I killed. He got away.
That fella seems to make a habit of that, doesn't he? Getting away, I mean.
Yeah, but it won't be forever. It would appear that I've got a trap set for him now, and sooner or later, he's gonna step into it.
You have a trap set?
Falcon held up the reward poster the sheriff had just given him.
I just realized this is a trap set for him. He said it himself, and I'm the bait.
Do me a favor and be careful, will you?
I'm always careful.
Ow! Shit!
It hurt to touch his ear, but Luke Mueller wanted to know how badly he'd been hit. From what he could determine, his earlobe had been shot clean off, leaving a bloody piece of mangled flesh. One more inch to the left and the bullet would have plowed into the back of his head. The current of the stream was running too swiftly to provide an image, but it did allow him to clean his ear. The cold water eased the pain a little. Had someone been on top of Superstition Mountain, looking down on the reddish-brown canyon floor, they would have seen one man walking slowly and with a slight limp, leading a mule. The man was walking with a definite purpose, for earlier he had picked out the exact spot where he intended to make camp for the night. Although he had not been keeping an exact count, it would be the 315th consecutive night spent in the desert. The old prospector's name was Ben Hanlon. Not knowing the exact date or year, he wasn't sure how old he was anymore. In his late 50s or early 60s, he figured. He could pretty much estimate the month by the position of the sun, and he was fairly certain he could come within a year or two of the correct year, though he wouldn't bet on it. He made his camp at the foot of Weaver's Needle, a tall rock obelisk so precisely formed it looked almost as if it had been made by the hand of man. Weaver's Needle guarded Superstition Mountain, and as Hanlon settled in for the evening, he looked up at the mountain.
"Well, Mr. Mountain, you have beaten a lot of men, and you may beat me as well. But I plan to give you one hell of a battle before I cross over that canyon."
Ben was tired from a full day of digging into crevices and breaking open rocks. It was all part of his ceaseless quest for the gold treasure of Superstition Mountain, known by everyone as the Peralta Vein. A kangaroo rat scampered out from under a mesquite tree, then waited quietly for a long moment to get its bearings. Ben saw the rat, but that rat did not see Ben. Very slowly, Ben reached for his short-handled pickaxe. With one quick practiced move, he brought the pick down on the rat's head, killing it instantly.
"Well, little fella, you dropped in just in time."
Ben pulled his knife from its scabbard and started to work.
"I was beginning to wonder what I was going to have for supper."
Working quickly and expertly, Ben skinned clean and spitted the rat. He cooked it over an open fire, watching it brown as his stomach churned with hunger. The rat was barely cooked before he took it off the skewer and began to eat it ravenously, not even waiting for it to cool. When all the meat was gone, he broke open the bones and sucked out the marrow. After his meal, he allowed himself a smoke. He filled his pipe 1/4 with tobacco and 3/4 with dried sweet grass in order to conserve his tobacco. Finally, with his hunger satisfied, he stretched out onto the ground, more hospitable in the cool of evening, listening to the quiet, almost melodious hoots of a great horned owl. He drifted off to sleep. Janelle had read about it, of course, but she had no idea how large America was until she started her journey 2 days ago. All day long, except for the occasional stops at places so tiny she wondered how they could call themselves towns, there had been nothing to see through the windows but wide open space. Earlier, she had asked the conductor if he could supply a board so she could write a letter, and he had obliged her with one. As it grew too dark for her to see anything outside, she used the light of the wall-mounted kerosene lantern to write the letter.
My dearest sister Sue, my heart is heavy with sadness over being separated from my baby, but I know that what I am doing now is the right thing. With every mile of distance I place between myself and New York, I am removing myself from the scandal and shame I brought on myself. Not until I am well clear of that will I be able to recover some sense of dignity and self-worth. I will try and describe for you some of the sights I have seen on this trip. First, I had no idea the size of this country. From New York, we can easily travel to Boston or Philadelphia or Baltimore within a day and, for the entire trip, be well aware of the civilization which surrounds us. And though the distance was long, such was the case as far as St. Louis, which likes to call itself the gateway to the West. It is modern and civilized in every way. As we crossed the Mississippi River, I counted almost 40 great riverboats tied up on the banks of the river. The city itself is filled with big buildings and teeming with masses of people. Except for the rather peculiar, flat-sounding accents, one could almost believe they were in New York. But the farther west I go, the less of civilization I see. I'm told we are in Kansas now, but for this entire day we could have been at sea. So flat and featureless is the land. Often the horizon is so far away and so clearly delineated that one gets the impression of seeing all the way to the outer edge of Earth itself. I find it all exciting and rather strangely magnificent. And were my heart not heavy with sorrow over the conditions which have placed me here, I rather think I might enjoy it. Please take care of my baby, and tell mother and father that I love them dearly. I do this so as to bring them no more sorrow. And Sue, my dearest, dearest darling sister, know that my love for you exceeds all bounds. Your sister, Janelle.
Finishing the letter, Janelle put it in an envelope, sealed it, and affixed to it a gray-blue Franklin 1-cent postage stamp. When the conductor walked by a short while later, she returned his writing board, then gave the missive to him to drop off at the next stop to be sent back on an eastbound train. Half an hour later, Janelle was in the lower bunk, which she preferred over the upper, because she could see through the window that way. A full and very bright moon painted the barren landscape in stark shades of black and silver. Seen at night, the landscape seemed softer, less harsh than it did by day under the blows of a midday sun. At such quiet, introspective moments, Janelle wondered if she had made a huge mistake in leaving New York to come to a land that she had never seen before. She thought of her baby. She missed him terribly, and she wished he had been old enough to understand why she felt it was necessary that she leave. Shortly after dawn pushed a golden fire over the notches of the Mazatzal Mountains, which lay to Ben Hanlon's east, he started work without eating. He could always eat later. Thinking he saw some color in the dirt under a small, spiny tree, Ben reached for his short-handled pickaxe, then moved over to the mesquite bush. He worked the hard-packed dirt around the mesquite bush, pulling up clods and breaking them into smaller pieces, looking for ore-bearing rock, working with the patience and skill developed by more than 20 years of desert prospecting. Born in South Carolina, Hanlon was 25 years old when he boarded a ship in Charleston Harbor to be part of the California Gold Rush. That was in 1849, and for several years, he panned enough gold from the rivers and creeks to keep himself going, though he never did make a big strike. Finally, hearing rumors of a gold mine discovered and then lost on Superstition Mountain of Arizona, said to be a vein of pure gold 10 feet high, 15 feet deep, and near about 1 mile long, he left California. Since coming to Arizona, Ben had very little interaction with people, though from time to time he ventured in from the wilderness to take some sort of job, staying just long enough to earn sufficient money to allow him to go back out to continue his quest. He didn't need much money to survive. Not too long after arriving in Arizona, he married an Apache woman. She taught him a lot about desert survival. As a result, he was adept at trapping animals for his food. He knew enough edible plants to consider the desert his own private garden. He knew the location of every source of water for miles, and he knew where to find salt. After a few years of isolation, the Apache woman had had enough and returned to her people.
Now, Rhoda, you just stay put. If you wander off, you're on your own, because I do not plan to be coming after you. And remember, I'm the one knows where to find water. What in tarnation do you want? Can't you see I'm working over here? All right. Tell me what's wrong. What? You got a thorn in your foot. All right, I know how them things can hurt. Lift up your foot here and let me,
Ben dropped to his knees where Rhoda had been scratching. There, on the ground at Rhoda's front two hooves, was a small pile of color-bearing rocks.
What in the world?
He began moving the rocks around.
Rhoda, is this real?
Pulling his knife from its leather scabbard, he scraped away the dirt and then poked the knife into the color.
Gold, Rhoda! These hair rocks, it's all gold nuggets, every damn one of them! Oh, looky here. They got more gold than they got rock. How the hell did they get here? Why are they just lying here? Where'd it come from? Oh, Rhoda, old girl, you know what you just done? You found what we've been looking for all these years. The next time we go into town, I'm gonna buy you the biggest sack of oats you ever seen.
Because he was without a horse, Falcon had to take a train back from Idaho Springs to McAllister.
All aboard!
Falcon was the last passenger to board.
Mr. McAllister, it's good to see you, sir. It's been a while since you rode with us.
Yeah, it has, hasn't it? How are you, Andy?
Oh, finest frogs here, Mr. McAllister.
Falcon left unstated the explanation as to why he was riding the train. Carrying his rifle low in his left hand, Falcon passed from the front to the rear of the car. Midway to the back, he saw a very pretty woman sitting next to a window. She noticed him looking at her and returned his gaze with a smile.
Ma'am?
He touched the brim of his hat and nodded as he continued toward the back of the car. Falcon chose a seat that was unoccupied so he could spread out a bit. It wasn't that he was too big to sit in one half of the seat. It was just that he found it more relaxing if he could have the entire seat to himself. Putting his rifle butt down on the floor between his knee and the wall of the car, he settled back to get comfortable for the ride. Janelle had almost blushed under the tall man's scrutiny. He was handsome, courteous, and possessed all the qualities that vile Boyd Zucker lacked. Why couldn't she have found someone like that? Then she scolded herself. What on earth was she thinking? She didn't even know that man. She had less than a 3-second encounter with him, a brief exchange of glances, and here she was extolling him with virtues that, though they may have been correct, were certainly not in evidence from the brief meeting. With nothing more than his looks and polite greeting to validate her hasty assessment of him, she was lamenting the fact that she had not met him before she had met Zucker. Besides, that man was armed to the teeth. He had a big pistol strapped to one side, a knife on the other, and he was carrying a rifle. Good Lord, did he expect to get into a war? No, she'd be way better off not getting such silly romantic notions in her head as to start fantasizing over some well-armed, albeit tall and very handsome, stranger on the train. Once the train pulled out of the station, Janelle again turned her attention to the magnificent scenery outside. The long trip from New York had been exhausting, and the first part of the trip through the farmlands of the Midwest had been flat out boring too. But since coming farther west, the vistas were becoming more and more magnificent, and she found that she was actually enjoying the trip, tiring though it might be. Janelle studied a young man dressed all in black who had boarded the train at Idaho Springs. The black was alleviated only by flashes of silver, a silver band around his hat, and a silver belt buckle. He wore a pistol with an ivory handle, and though she had grown somewhat used to seeing armed men over the last couple of days, most were wearing their weapons in an understated way. This young man made a show of his pistol. There was just something about him, a cockiness and an arrogance that she found most unappealing. When he rose and came closer to her seat, she turned to look out the window so as not to make eye contact with him. She sensed, though, that he had stopped right beside her seat. She willed herself not to look around, hoping and praying that he would just take the hint and pass her by.
Now, darling, how you think that makes me feel? You staring out the window like that just to keep from looking at me. Why, that's pure insulting.
Oh, I'm sorry. I meant no insult.
I think you did mean to insult me.
Please, won't you leave me alone?
What happens if I don't leave you alone?
I'll tell you this, mister. You aren't gonna like what happens if you don't leave her alone.
Mister, if you don't start minding your own business, I'm gonna... the hell?
The young man had started reaching for his pistol as he was talking, but now he realized his pistol wasn't in his holster.
Are you looking for this?
Falcon showed the man his pearl-handled Colt.
What are you doing with my gun?
Keeping you alive. If you still had this pistol, you might try and use it on me. And then, I'd have to kill you.
Who the hell do you think you are?
Mr. McAllister, is there any trouble here?
No trouble, Andy. As long as you keep this arrogant young fool out of this car...
Oh, McAllister? Did you call him McAllister?
That's his name, Falcon McAllister.
Oh, hell, Mr. McAllister, I'm sorry, I didn't mean no harm.
I'm not the one you need to apologize to.
The young man turned quickly to Janelle.
I'm sorry, ma'am, I was just, well, I don't exactly know what I was just doing, but I promise you I won't be doing it no more.
That's quite all right.
Falcon emptied all the cartridges from the young man's pistol, then handed it over to the conductor.
Hold on to this, will you, Andy? Give it back to him when he gets off the train.
Yes, sir. I'll be glad to do that. Come along, son. I'll find you seated. One of the other cars.
Janelle watched as the young man, much less arrogant now, meekly followed the conductor out of the car.
I don't know how to thank you, Mr. McAllister.
My pleasure. I hope the rest of your trip is a pleasant one.
And then that tall, handsome man, who Janelle now could truly call her hero, returned to his seat in the back of the car. Had she known he'd be getting off at the next stop, she just might have found the courage to ask him to join her. But soon her knight in shining armor was going to be gone, their brief encounter like ships that pass in the night. A week later, Luke Mueller's horse stepped into a prairie dog hole, and Mueller had to shoot him. He threw his saddle over his shoulder and began walking. Although his ear was healing now, it was still sore, and he knew it must look a sight. With every step, he renewed his hatred for Falcon McAllister. He swore to himself that he would get him. Or maybe somebody else would kill him. That'd be all right, too. He didn't care who killed him. He just wanted that son of a bitch dead. He'd walked about 2 miles when he saw a little trading post that stood all alone, weather-beaten and drooping. It was the first building of any kind he had seen in the last 10 miles. Otherwise indistinguishable from any other desert shack, it was noticeable only because a crudely painted sign had been mounted on the roof, large enough to catch the attention of anyone who might come by. Bloom's Store. Beer. Eats. Goods. Though it was isolated, the building sat squarely on a much-used trail, making it a welcome sight to travelers who might be hungry or thirsty, or just needing to hear another human voice. Mueller dropped his saddle on the front porch.
Ooh.
The interior of the store was dark. Light just barely filtered through the dirty windows or the dust-mote-laden bars that stabbed in through the cracks between the weathered gray plank walls. The store smelled of the various products offered for sale. Salt-cured bacon, flour, dried beans, and stale beer. A middle-aged, very plump woman was sweeping the floor, and a very thin, bald-headed man was standing behind the counter.
Your name, Bloom?
Yes, sir. Just like the sign says. My, oh my, what happened to your ear?
It got bit off by a dog.
All I can say is that is one mean dog.
Was.
Beg pardon?
He was one mean dog. I shot him.
I wouldn't wonder. So what can I do you for?
I have a beer.
Yes, sir. One beer coming up. I expect this is going to be tasting awfully good to you on this hot day. Most especially since I seen you walking up here carrying your saddle on your shoulder. You being a little fellow and all, that must have been some load you was toting. I don't mean no disrespect by that, you know, saying you was little and all.
Luke Mueller had a mustache but no beard. He was in his late 30s with a face that showed the effects of spending more time outside than in. He had a three-corner scar on his forehead and a crescent-shaped scar on his right cheek. His right earlobe was mangled and covered with crusty, dark red, almost brown scar tissue. He had gray eyes and dirty blonde hair, and as Bloom had noted, he stood no more than 5 feet 2 inches tall.
You see me walking, did you?
Yes, sir. I've been watching you come up for the last 10 minutes or so. I pointed you out to my wife over there. Isn't that right, Pearl? Didn't I tell you we got us a customer coming?
Pearl didn't look up from her sweeping.
That's what you done, all right.
What happened to your horse, mister?
He stepped in a hole and broke his leg, so I had to shoot him.
Ouch! I'm sorry to hear that. I know folks tend to get real close to their horses. I sure have gotten close to mine. He's not only fast, he's got a heart so big he can run for hours without ever getting tired.
Yeah, well, I ain't gonna get all weepy-eyed and start crying and blowing snot over it. It's just a horse.
I didn't mean to imply that you would. I was just saying, losing a horse is no easy thing, most especially if it leaves you a foot like this one here has done you.
That's true. And it's good you taking note of that, 'cause seeing as you know all about it now, I reckon you also know I'll be needing a horse.
Oh, yeah, I figured you would. Unfortunately, I can't help you with that. Not directly, that is. But I do have a room in the back, which I'll let you use for no more than a dollar. And that will include your supper and your breakfast. The stage comes through tomorrow morning around 9, and it'll take you on to Pinon.
Pinon? Colorado?
Pinon, Arizona. You're in Arizona territory now.
Oh, I'll be damned. I didn't know that.
No reason you should know it, but with no signs and all. Lots of folks coming through here don't know if they're in Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, or Arizona. That's because they're all so close together right here. Anyhow, like I was saying, it'll only cost you a dollar to stay here for the night, and you can go on into Pinon tomorrow and buy yourself a horse.
I won't be staying here, because I ain't going into town.
What are you talking about, mister? You can't just go walking through the desert like you was doing when you come up here. I could tell by looking at you that you was nigh on to Dunin.
I want your horse.
Well, I reckon you do. Like I said, he is not only the fastest horse around, he's got more endurance than any horse I have ever seen. Oh, but I am sorry, mister. My horse ain't for sale.
Look, you don't understand. I ain't talking about buying your horse, Bloom. I'm just gonna take it.
Mine?
I said I plan to take your horse.
Are you telling me you're figuring on stealing my horse?
Yeah.
Like hell you are, you little dried-up son of a bitch!
Reaching under the counter, Bloom pulled out a double-barreled shotgun. But before he could even swing it around, Mueller drew his pistol.
Ah! David!
Mueller then turned his pistol on the woman. Mueller grabbed $36 from Bloom's cash box, bacon, flour, and a full sack of beans.
Phoenix, Arizona Territory!
It was mid-afternoon when Janelle stepped down from the train. It was so hot she was scarcely able to catch her breath. She had experienced some very warm days in New York, but the wall of heat that washed over her now was unlike anything she had ever known before. Seeing a bench set up under the roof that extended out over the depot platform, she sat down, then looked around to examine the place. Janelle had chosen this city for a reason. Phoenix was a mythical bird that could arise from its own ashes. She considered that allegorical to her own condition. Could she arise from the ashes of her own life? Janelle looked around at the place that was to be her new home. She noticed that nearly every man carried a gun, many in a holster that hung from their belt, but nearly as many carried their pistol stuck down into the waistband of their trousers. She had $141 in cash on her person. She wondered if she should be frightened that one of those armed men would rob her. But surely they would not do so in broad daylight in front of so many people. She knew the money she had would last her for a while. But what was she going to do after that money ran out? She had thought only to get away from the shame and disgrace. She hadn't given any thought at all to what she would do to sustain herself.
No, this isn't right. This isn't at all what I ordered.
This is the order that arrived on the train for you, Mrs. Buckner.
Then send it back.
I'll be glad to send it back if you want me to. But if I send it back, you do understand that you will have to pay the shipping charges, don't you? And from the way I read the bill of lading, you have already paid for the product and there is no refund. So all you'd be doing is giving the product away.
But I ordered bonnets.
The woman pulled out an unusual looking hat and held it up.
Does this look like a bonnet to you?
No, ma'am. The truth is, I don't know what you would call these here things.
That is called a three-story hat.
The woman looked around toward Janelle.
I beg your pardon?
I'm sorry. Please forgive me for butting in where I had no right.
What did you say this was?
She held the hat out toward Janelle.
A three-story hat. It's also referred to as a flower pot hat. Bonnets are so passé now. The three-story hat is all the rage.
Is that a fact? And just where is this place that they are all the rage?
I'm sorry, I've said too much already. Please, forgive me.
No, my dear, there is nothing to forgive. Believe me, I'm very interested. Please, have you some involvement in fashion?
I suppose that depends upon your definition of the term involvement. To hear my father tell it, one would think that my sister and I supported the entire fashion industry of New York. Now, while we were quite active in our shopping, to say that we supported the entire fashion industry would be quite an exaggeration.
But you do understand fashion, don't you, my dear? I mean, how else would you know about these, flower pots?
Yes. They have become quite popular of late. I'm afraid the ladies in New York consider bonnets to be rather matronly.
My husband and I own Buckner's Ladies Emporium here in the town. Do you think I'll be able to sell these?
If you have enough young ladies who want to be fashionable, yes, I'm certain you will be able to sell them.
Oh. You wouldn't like to help me sell them, would you?
I beg your pardon?
What are you doing in Phoenix? Do you have a job? Do you need a job? Oh, dear. Listen to me. Now it is I who should ask for forgiveness. I have no right to impose myself into your private affairs that way.
No. No, you aren't imposing at all. I don't have a job, and yes, I do need a job.
My name is Nellie Buckner. My husband, Ken, and I own Buckner's Ladies Emporium. How would you like to come work for us?
I would love to, but first I have to find a place to live.
That won't be hard, and I can take care of that for you as well, if you would like. I have a friend who owns a boarding house. A very nice and genteel boarding house. Come with me, I'll introduce you to her.
But my luggage...
You'll be taking her to Mrs. Poindexter's?
Yes, Mr. Donovan. Would you please see to it that Miss... Oh, my. It would appear that I have just hired you, and I don't even know your name.
My name is Wellington. Janelle Wellington.
Ah, please see to it that Miss Wellington's luggage is delivered to the Poindexter house.
Yes, ma'am.
Now, Janelle, may I call you Janelle?
Oh, please do.
Janelle, come with me. We'll get you all moved in. Then I'll take you over to the store to introduce you to my husband and show you where you will be working.
Oh, before I go, if you don't mind, I would like to send a telegram back to New York to let my family know that I have arrived safely.
Yes, of course you can. I'll wait right here.
Western Union is just inside the depot, Miss Wellington.
Thank you.
Once inside, Janelle wrote her message out on a tablet, then slid it across to the telegrapher. He looked at it, then crossed out the period after the word spirits and added the word stop.
What are you doing?
Well, there ain't no code for periods, so we use stop. I'm in Phoenix and in good spirits. Stop. All my love, Janelle. Well, we take out the words I am and all my and. The message would then read, in Phoenix in good spirits. Stop. Love, Janelle. See, we don't count the word love and we don't count your name. The words that you got left on the paper here will send all the message you're wanting to send, and this way, it'll only cost you 90 cents. You'll save 75 cents.
Oh, thank you. That is very kind of you.
Customer service, that's what Western Union's all about, ma'am.
When Janelle stepped back outside, she noticed a disturbance where an old woman was selling food items from her push cart.
Hey, what are you doing here?
The man yelling was wearing a vest upon which was pinned a star.
I'll not have you coming into my town bothering the decent citizens.
I do nothing wrong, Senor Deputy.
You are breaking the law.
Donovan rushed over to the food cart.
Senora Munoz isn't bothering anyone, Deputy Appleby. All in the world she's doing is selling tacos. And most of the folks that come here like them. Besides, I gave her permission to be on the railroad property.
Yeah. Well, I ain't give her permission to sell anything in this town.
The new man to arrive on the scene, a big man with a bushy mustache, was also wearing a star.
Marshal Cairns, it's like I told Deputy Appleby, Senora Munoz has my permission to be on railroad property. She isn't breaking any law.
She has no business license. Being as I'm the marshal, I'm the one who decides who is and who isn't breaking the law.
She isn't breaking any law, and she doesn't need a business license as long as she's on railroad property. The railroad has a business license that covers anyone who does business on our property with our permission. and I gave her permission to be here.
Who said she don't need a business license?
Why, you can look it up for yourself, Marshal Cairns. It's in the municipal code.
If she don't buy herself a license, that means she ain't paying any taxes. And if she ain't paying taxes, I'm not getting my cut.
Your cut?
Hell yeah, my cut. How you think me and my deputies get paid? When the city council hired me, they agreed to pay me a base salary and 2% of all business license fees and taxes.
Well, that may be, but Señor Munoz is not in violation.
Cairns nodded knowingly at Appleby. The deputy picked up one side of the cart and turned it over, spilling the contents onto the ground.
No, señor!
It don't matter now, does it? She don't have nothing to sell.
Marshal Cairns, you shouldn't have done that.
Donovan, I'll thank you not to be telling me what I should and shouldn't be doing. I'm the marshal here, and I do what I damn well please. Let this be a warning to you. Don't be letting indigents come into my town and use your property to get around the law.
In the first place, she isn't an indigent. She makes enough money selling tacos to support herself and her two children. In the second place, I told you she is not violating any law. And in the third place, what made this your town?
I made it my town. Maybe she ain't breaking the law now, but I intend to talk to the city council today to get that law changed. If you try and help that Mex woman or anyone else get around it, I'll throw them and you in jail.
After the marshal and his deputy walked away, Janelle went over to help the old woman.
Gracias, señorita. Gracias.
Nellie and Mr. Donovan also pitched in.
You are a good woman, Janelle.
Please don't tell me those awful men were really officers of the law.
I wish I didn't have to tell you that, but unfortunately they are. Cairns is our city marshal, duly appointed by the city council, and he hired Appleby, who is just as bad.
I can't help but wonder how in the world the city council could have ever been foolish enough to appoint such an evil man as Mr. Cairns. What they should have done, after Harold Wallace retired, was appoint Deputy Forbes as marshal. He was Marshal Wallace's deputy, and he is a good man.
John is a good man, but the city council thought he was too young.
Well, if this is what your marshal is like, I certainly hope that I never get on his bad side.
Oh, honey, you can't help but get on his bad side. That's the only side he has.
Finally, the scattered meats and vegetables were cleaned up and put in a trash container. They set the cart back upright, and Donovan felt the wheels and axles, and then announced the cart was undamaged.
Oh, gracias, señor.
Come, Janelle, my dear. I'll take you over and introduce you to Mrs. Poindexter. She's a wonderful lady and runs a clean and orderly boarding house. I think you will be quite comfortable there.
Thank you.
I certainly hope you don't think everyone is like the marshal. Oh, I would hate for you to get a bad impression about Western men.
Well, how could I have a bad impression of all Western men? Mr. Donovan is a Westerner, isn't he? And he certainly seems like a very good man.
Yes, he is.
And I met a man named Falcon McAllister on the train.
You met Falcon McAllister?
Yes. Why? Do you know him?
I don't know him, but I heard of him. His name is quite well known throughout the West.
Oh, dear. Is he an outlaw?
An outlaw? Oh, no, my dear. Quite the contrary. Although he's not a full-time lawman, he has the reputation of being the nemesis of all outlaws. Some even call him a genuine Western hero.
He came to my rescue on the train.
Oh? Do tell.
Janelle related the events of the train ride.
Evidently, Falcon McAllister made quite an impression on you.
He did, I admit. I do believe he is the most handsome man I've ever met. No, I can't say that exactly. I've seen some very handsome men in New York, of course, but most of them are, well, I'm not sure what expression to use, but they are what I would call dandies. Mr. McAllister was handsome, but he was sort of rough-looking, too.
Oh, my. I think if you stay in our West long enough, you will meet just such a man and stay out here.
Who knows? When one begins a new adventure, one never can tell what lies ahead.
Every afternoon at 2 o'clock, Nellie's husband, Ken Buckner, and a few other businessmen met in the Boar's Head Saloon for one beer. Nellie didn't mind Ken's visits. He never abused the situation, never stayed more than 1 hour, and she had her own ritual, a morning tea with some of the other ladies in town. Most of the time, Ken's visits were pleasant, with friendly conversation and good-natured bantering. But today, Corey Minner, a saloon patron and known bully, was feeling ornery. He called himself a cowboy, but he'd been fired from 3 outfits already. He was currently unemployed, and nobody knew exactly how he was making a living, though he had coerced some of the cowboys he had worked with in the past to lend him money. He sometimes did take on odd jobs, but many suspected he was responsible for a string of petty burglaries that had taken place recently.
Hey, Buckner, how come you ain't wearing a dress?
Ken didn't answer.
You hear me? You work in a store for ladies. How come you ain't wearing a dress?
Ken started to stand up, but one of the other businessmen put his hand on Ken's arm.
Yes, sir. I think you'd look just real purty in a dress.
Ken Buckner stood up then, and he turned to face Minner. Minner was a young man in his early 20s, and Ken was in his late 50s.
You like thinking about men in dresses, do you, Minner? I find that interesting. I never knew that about you. Of course, you may find Phoenix too small a place for someone like you. Might be better off in, San Francisco, where there are others of your kind.
While Minner didn't know exactly what Ken was implying, he realized that somehow his taunting had been turned back on him, and he was now the butt of the joke.
You son of a bitch! You talk to me like that, you better draw your gun!
I don't wear a gun, Minner.
Yeah, well, that's your mistake, Buckner, 'cause I do!
So do I.
Looking towards the door, the saloon patron saw Deputy John Forbes standing there, with his gun in his hand.
This ain't none of your business, Forbes.
Yeah, it is my business. Because I'm the deputy marshal. Now, you've got 2 choices. You can either unbuckle that gun belt and let it fall to the floor, or you can get out of here.
You can't arrest me. I ain't done nothing.
I'm not arresting you. I'm just telling you to get rid of your gun before you get yourself into trouble.
Minner glared at Forbes for a long time, but then his face broke into a smile.
Oh, you don't have to get all mad about it. I was just funning Buckner, that's all.
Minner turned toward Buckner.
No hard feelings, Buckner. I was just funning.
With a shrug of his shoulders, Corey Minner left the saloon.
Everything else going all right in here?
It's going fine, Deputy. Thank you.
Forbes took a quick glance around, then nodded at everyone before he left the saloon.
I cannot understand why the hell City Council didn't pick him as the new marshal instead of Cairns.
Luke Mueller had stumbled on a small, intermittent stream of water in the Sonoran Desert. It was the Agua Fria River, though he had no idea what the name was. The water was alkaline and relatively bitter, but it was drinkable, so he wasn't in any danger of dying of thirst. But hunger was another thing. 2 days ago, he had made 4 biscuits and cooked 4 pieces of bacon from the last of the food he had stolen from Bloom. He had eaten the bacon and 2 of his biscuits at the river the day before, and 1 that morning, leaving only 1 biscuit remaining. He had a decision to make now. Should he eat his last biscuit or save it? Even if he saved the biscuit for later, he'd still have the next day to contend with. Eating it now might stave off the hunger a bit. If he waited, he'd be so hungry the biscuit would do little to take the edge off the hunger. The question was answered for him when he saw some sort of structure ahead of him, rising from the ground like another hillock. As he drew closer, he saw it was a man-made structure, built of adobe brick and sun-bleached wood. The question as to whether it was empty or occupied was answered when he got closer. because a crude hand-lettered sign nailed to the roof read, Paul Baker's Way Stop, Beer Eats. Mueller was indeed tickled with the unexpected improvement of his situation. True, he had eaten all the food he had stole from Bloom, but he had not spent one penny of the money he took. He still had all $36 in his pocket. When he reached the other side of the building, he was surprised to see two freight wagons parked out front. He pushed through a hanging piece of canvas and stepped inside.
Damn!
For a moment, he thought he'd gone blind. Outside, the sun was so bright that he'd been keeping his eyes at a squint. Inside, he could barely see. The room was illuminated only by the light that streamed in through two windows and the space between the roof and the top of the walls. He stood for a long moment, trying to adjust his eyes.
It do be dark in here when a fella first comes in out of the bright sunlight, don't it?
Although Mueller's eyes had not yet adjusted enough for him to see who was speaking, the man's voice gave him a pretty good mental image.
Don't be worried none about it. Just stand there a minute, you'll see again.
Mueller's eyesight did return, and he saw that in addition to the bartender who spoke, there were two other men in the room. Mueller walked over to the bar, which consisted of a few boards laid across a couple of empty beer barrels.
What can I do for you, sonny?
Anything wet.
Hey, Paul Baker, don't you have a wet wash rag there? Give that to him.
I wouldn't do that to man nor beast. If I ever seen me a fella that needed him a beer, it's this fella here. Hey, here you go, mister.
Mueller had hoped to find the place deserted except for the proprietor. That way, he could have done to Paul Baker exactly what he did to David Bloom and his wife.
I didn't expect there'd be anybody here.
Oh, yeah. Being as I'm on the road between Phoenix and Tempe, I get a lot of business in here. Mostly from freight wagon men like Frank and D.W. over there. That'll be a nickel.
What?
The beer. That'll be a nickel. I didn't say nothing about it before, seeing as you had quite a thirst on.
Mueller turned to the two other men.
Hey, them your wagons parked out front?
Yeah.
Well, they ain't exactly our wagons. They belong to the Phoenix Express Company. We just drive them.
Phoenix? What's that?
You ain't never heard of Phoenix?
Can't say as I have.
Well, it happens to be the biggest city in all Arizona, is all.
Big? How big?
I'd say nigh on 3,000 or so live there. Wouldn't you say that, D.W.?
Oh, 3,000 at least. Oh, close to, anyways.
What they got there? I'll have another.
Yes, sir. I knew you was powerful thirsty when you come in here.
I was. And I'm hungry, too. I'd like you to fix me something to eat.
Yes, sir. You just go over there to one of them tables, and I'll bring it out to you directly.
Mueller went over and sat down, then looked back at the two drivers.
I asked what they got in Phoenix.
Why, they got near about anything a man would want. They got liquor, food, women.
And the meanest son of a bitch of a city marshal you ever seen.
What about the marshal?
Are you an outlaw?
What?
I don't mean nothing by asking was you an outlaw. It's just that if you was an outlaw, you wouldn't have nothing to worry about. He don't go after outlaws. About the only thing our marshal goes after is free drinks at the saloons.
And finding ways to get decent folks in trouble so they'll have to pay a fine for things like spitting in the street.
Frank, you wasn't exactly spitting in the street.
Same as?
No, it weren't the same as. What you was doing was pissing in the street.
I was standing around the corner so nobody could see me. He didn't have no call to arrest me. What he was wanting was the fine. That's what he was wanting.
So what you done is you paid a dollar just to take a piss.
It ain't all that damn funny, D.W.
Here's your food.
For the next several moments while Mueller was busy eating, he returned to his own private thoughts. He had never been to Phoenix. He had never even heard of it, so even if there was anybody there who had ever heard of him, there was for sure nobody there who would recognize him on sight. Ever since he had left Colorado, he'd been wandering around with no specific purpose or destination. That had all changed now. Luke Mueller was going to Phoenix. In the town named for him, the bronze statue of Jamie Ian McAllister had arrived by train nearly 3 weeks ago and was being stored in the Foster Matthews warehouse. The intent was to keep it out of sight of the public until the actual unveiling on July 4th, less than a week away now. Falcon and most of his siblings were given a private viewing, and from there they went out to the old homestead in McAllister Valley. It belonged to all of them, but by consensus of all the others, it was occupied by Falcon. He and his brothers, Jamie Ian IV, Morgan, and Matthew, were standing over the graves of their parents. Falcon's sisters, Jolene, Megan, and Kathleen, were on their knees tending to the flowers on the graves.
I wish Andrew and Rosanna were going to be here.
Well, they can't, Jolene.
I know that's what they said. I'm just not sure why they can't. That's all.
Because they're closing one play on the 4th, and they've got a new play opening on the 11th. It would be almost impossible for them to be here.
They could postpone the play, couldn't they?
There's no way they could do that. Those plays cost thousands of dollars to produce. You can't just postpone them.
Still, it's too bad Andrew and Rosanna won't be here, that's all.
Morgan McAllister pointed to a batch of flowers.
Megan, you ought to put those purple ones over there.
If you feel you can do it better, brother, feel free to pitch on in.
All right, I will. There. Oh, hell.
Morgan held his hand up toward Falcon.
Help an old man up, will you, little brother?
Oh, man, you're only 53.
Now wait until you're 53.
Shoot. When Paul was 60, he single-handedly wiped out Layfield's entire gang.
Wasn't quite single-handed. He had a few good men with him. Preacher and Smoke Jensen, among others.
Paul's name will forever be linked with it, though.
Matthew turned to Falcon.
Of course, little brother, your name is as well-known as Paul's name ever was.
Not even close, Matthew.
Nevertheless, the way you took out the Mueller gang 4-1 is the stuff of legends. Carry on the McAllister name.
Oh, I carry on the family name? It seems to me like you folks have been doing well enough in carrying on the family name with the number of nephews and nieces I have. Good Lord, half of the people in the valley are McAllisters. Well, not half maybe, but they're what, 50, 60 by now?
103.
103? Can that be right?
Kathleen rose to her feet.
If Jolene says 103, you can count on it. She's the family historian.
When are you going to settle down, Falcon?
I am settled down, Jamie Ian.
Right. That little fracas over in Blackhawk was nothing more than a minor disagreement.
The sons of bitches murdered the Reverend and Mrs. Powell. You know that.
Yeah. I know it. And I say good for you for squaring accounts.
Accounts are not squared.
You're talking about Luke Mueller?
When I find him, accounts will be squared.
You could let the law handle that, couldn't you?
I could. Luke Mueller has made it personal.
Luke Mueller's made it personal? How'd he do that?
Falcon reached into his pocket and produced the reward poster Luke Mueller had put out on him.
Like I said, Luke Mueller has made it personal.
Jamie Ian read the poster and then passed it around to the others.
Falcon, it's been a while since I wore my guns, but I still know how to use them. And if you want me, I'll come with you.
Thanks for the offer, Jamie Ian, but there's no sense in getting any more of the family involved in this.
Are you going after him?
I don't think that's going to be necessary. Seeing as he's made me a target, all I'm going to have to do is keep my eyes open. I'm pretty sure our paths will cross again someday. And when they do, I'll be ready for the bastard.
For a moment, they all breathed in the silence.
How do you like your new horse, Falcon?
I like him just fine, Morgan. He's a good horse. Of course, the one Luke Mueller killed was a good one, too.
Kathleen looked over at the big bronze stallion.
He's a beautiful horse. What have you named him?
Lightning.
Lightning? That was
the name of Paul's horse. Yeah.
Megan looked down at the grave of their father.
I think Paul would like that.
Yeah. In fact, I think he liked the fact that Falcon named a horse after his horse a lot more than the idea of having a life-size statue of him standing in the middle of Cade Boulevard.
Oh, I don't know. I sort of think that might please him, too.
Paul wasn't one for personal glory.
No, but he was real proud of what he and Ma started here in the valley. And I think the statue speaks to that more than anything else.
Well, I think so, too. I just know he'll be there with us next Monday.
What was it he and Ma called heaven?
The Starry Trail.
I figured that come Monday, Pa and Ma will both be looking down on us from the Starry Trail.
It took Luke Mueller less than 2 hours to ride from Paul Baker's way stop to Phoenix, a bustling community with a surprising amount of traffic in the street, from large, heavily laden and lumbering freight wagons to ranch buckboards to surreys. The sidewalks were filled with pedestrians. Just ahead, he saw the Boar's Head Saloon and started toward it. He rode right out in front of an approaching surrey.
Hey, watch where you're riding, mister!
Mueller spurred his horse forward and reacted quickly, carrying him out of danger. Looking back over his shoulder, he saw the frightened look in the face of a lone woman passenger. For some reason that he couldn't explain, he found her fear of him pleasurable and smiled, though not at her.
Sorry, Mrs. Guthrie. That fool just caught right in front of us. Giddy up!
That's quite all right, Mr. Conley. You handled it in beautifully.
Thank you, ma'am. Here we are.
The driver stopped the surrey in front of Buckner's Ladies Emporium. He stepped around to help Mrs. Guthrie exit.
Shall I wait out here for you, ma'am?
Yes, please, if you don't mind. Oh.
She took his hand as she stepped down.
I shan't be too long.
Mrs. Guthrie, how nice to see you.
Did you see that awful man in the street?
No, I'm afraid I didn't.
He cut right in front of us. Had it not been for Mr. Conley's skillful driving, why, the surrey could have been upset.
Oh, dear. How glad I am that didn't happen. Now, what can I do for you?
Mr. Guthrie and I are going to Philadelphia for my niece's wedding, and the gown I wear simply must be of the latest fashion. My sister believes that because we are living in the Far West, we must all dress as savage Indians, and I want to prove her wrong.
Well, let us see what we can find for you, if you'll follow me.
Because the saloon was out of the sun, it was a few degrees cooler, but only marginally so. There were several young men in the back corner, along with a young woman whose dress made it evident that she was an employee of the saloon. Mueller stepped up to the bar.
What can I do for you, mister?
Beer.
Old Quince is on a roll today.
Quince?
You see the young feller over there with the fancy gun and holster? That's Quince Anders. He works for Murdoch Felton, who owns the Flying F Ranch. Well, fact is, all them boys work for Mr. Felton.
Oh, that's quite a holster set he's wearing.
Yes, sir. Quince is really good with a gun, so I reckon the holster ain't out of place.
What do you mean when you say he's good with a gun? I've been around a lot, but I ain't never heard of someone called Quince Anders.
Oh, don't get me wrong. He ain't what you would call a gunfighter or nothing like that. I mean, he ain't never killed nobody, but he's about the fastest I ever seen, and he always hits what he's shooting at.
The hell I can't. I know damn well I can do it.
You willing to put your money where your mouth is?
What do you mean?
I'll bet you a quarter you can't do it.
Uh-uh. A quarter ain't enough money. You want me to prove it to you, Stanley? It's going to cost more than a quarter.
How much more?
$5.
$5? I ain't got $5.
We get paid Saturday. I'll hold your marker till then. Of course, you may be right. It could be that I can't do it at all. Then you would be $5 richer.
Yeah, I would, wouldn't I? All right, let's make it certain what we're betting on. And what you're telling me is that you are going to hold a glass of whiskey on the back of your hand, out shoulder high, and then turn your hand, draw your pistol, and hit the glass before it hits the floor. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying.
And we're talking about a whiskey shot glass, not a beer mug, right?
Damn, Stanley, you're sure making it hard on me.
Hey, see, fellas, I didn't think he'd take me up on it.
Oh, I didn't say I wasn't going to take you up on it. I just said you were making it hard on me. Is it a bet?
Yeah, it's a bet.
Quince picked up a whiskey glass and put it on the back of his hand, then held his hand out.
Wait a damn minute. Hold it, Quince. You ain't planning on doing that in here, are you?
Why not?
Why not? Because it's dangerous shooting inside. That's why not. You're likely to hit someone or put somebody's eye out. At the very least, you'll be putting a bullet hole in my floor.
Come on, Wally. It ain't like you don't have about a dozen holes in your floor already. Besides, look at it this way. Once I do this, folks will be wanting to come here to have a drink in the saloon where the great Quince Anders done the best shooting that's ever been done.
Mueller turned his back to the bar so he could have an unrestricted view of what was going on.
Well, I say this for you, Quince. Sure have a high opinion of yourself, all right. Go ahead. Well, try it. Go on. Huh? If you can do it, you're right. It might be a good advertisement from a place. If you can't do it, well, it's good to see you getting your comeuppance.
There ain't going to be no comeuppance, Wally. You can count on that.
Mueller watched Quince Anders as he put the glass on the back of his hand one more time, his arms stretched out full at shoulder height.
Somebody need to count or something?
No need to count. Just hush and let me do this.
All eyes were on Quince. He turned his hand and the whiskey glass started toward the floor. Quince had not been the one who broke the glass.
I'll be damned, I never seen nothing like that.
Looking over at Wally, the mystery was solved. The others saw Luke Mueller standing with his back to the bar, holding a pistol. A small stream of smoke drifting from the barrel.
Mister, what the hell did you do that for? You messed up my trick.
Wasn't much of a trick. You've seen how easy I shot the glass.
Yeah? Well, let me tell you what I'm going to do now. I'm going to come over there and whip your scrawny ass, you little shit.
Mueller put his pistol back in his holster. Then he smiled a cold, humorless smile at Quince.
I don't think you want to do that.
Why don't I want to do that? You just cost me $5 is what you done.
I'll give you a chance to get your $5 back.
How?
Shoot against me.
For $5?
Or more.
What will we shoot at?
Oh, I thought you knew. We shoot against each other.
What? Are you crazy?
I might be. After all, you've been telling everyone how good you were. I'd have to be crazy to want to go against you, wouldn't I?
One of us could get killed if we did that.
Yeah, that's generally the way it happens. One of us always gets killed. So far, it hadn't been me. Will it be, cowboy? Shall we settle this little dispute between us?
Quinn stared at Mueller for a long moment, as if unable to believe he had gotten caught up in such a deadly game.
No!
Quinn held both hands out in front of him, palms facing outward.
No, I ain't going to do this!
Quinn turned quickly and left the saloon.
No, you didn't leave him much there, partner. He wasn't harming nobody.
Luke picked up his beer.
Give me another beer.
What's your name, mister?
My name ain't none of your business.
No, sir, no. You're right, ain't none of my business. I didn't mean nothing by asking. I'm just being friendly, y'all.
I don't need no friends.
No, sir. I reckon you don't.
Wally walked to the far end of the bar. Luke Mueller didn't want anyone to know who he was, nor did he want to be bothered by anyone. It was for that reason that he had shot the glass Quince dropped. That little exhibition had had the desired effect, too. It had generated fear and respect in everyone who saw it.